Welcome everybody. Good evening. Welcome. Everybody can make it here tonight. It's a chilly night, but we'll power through here and get you all home safely. Since you didn't have any snow up here, I mean, down in Delmar, and you'll hear Delmar a lot. I like to talk about Delmar, so get ready for that.
Okay.
But anyway, welcome. I'm Sean Brittingham, President of the State Board of Education. I called the February 20th regular meeting to order. It is 5 p.m. The meeting is open to the public in person in the cabinet room of the Townsend Building in Dover, Delaware, and electronically via Zoom. The Delaware State Board of Education published a public meeting notice and meeting information on February 13th on the state public meeting calendar. Thank you for your patience if we run into any technology issues as we simultaneously conduct this meeting in person and electronically. Today's agenda contains two opportunities for public comment. There is time allotted for regulations and then general public comment near the end of the meeting. Sign-up sheets are available on the table by the door. If you did not previously sign up to provide public comment via email and are logged in through the meeting URL, please type in your name, organization, and comment topic in the chat box now. If you have joined through the call-in option and wish to make verbal public comment, please log in online through the meeting URL. As required by statute, this meeting is being recorded and the recording will be available to the public on our website within 7 business days of this meeting. When voting on items for action, I will ask all those in favor say aye, and we will only do a roll call if there is a dissent. Also, as a reminder, when speaking or making a motion, please state your name first. Mr. Avila, please do a roll call of the Delaware State Board of Education members.
Yes, sir. Mr. Brenham?
Present.
Dr. Griffin?
Present.
Dr. Latavia?
Present.
Reverend Powell?
Present.
Mr. Sawney?
Present.
Mr. Simmons?
Present.
Ms. Stevens?
Present.
Dr. Zaba?
Present.
Mr. President, you have a quorum.
Thank you. Deputy Attorney General Alex Corbin and State Board staff Kathleen Smith and Marco Avila are participating in today's meetings. Approval of the agenda. The board's agenda was posted on February 13th. If there are no changes to the agenda, I will entertain a motion to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting as presented.
Griffin, I move that we approve the January 16th, 2025. Excuse me, the February 20th. I'm moving ahead in the agenda. I move that we approve the February 20th meeting agenda posted.
I see what he did. Thank you. Griffin's made a motion. I need a second.
Latavia, second.
Latavia, second. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Approval of the January 16th regular meeting minutes. The January 16th regular meeting minutes were provided to the board in review in advance of this meeting. If there are no additions or deletions, I would entertain a motion to approve the January 16th regular meeting minutes as presented.
Stevens, so moved.
Stevens has made a motion. I need a second.
Reverend Powell, second.
Powell, second. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. I'd like to introduce Delaware's new Secretary of Education, Cindy Martin. We welcome you. It's a pleasure to have you here. We're looking for a great working relationship and to keep Delaware moving forward. We want to be first, not second. So just keep that in the back of your mind or in the front, but
always
I'll have all the board members introduce themselves first. So you do get to know us a little bit. You'll find this is a great group to work with. Like I told you, I'm humbled every time I'm in a room with them because they're thinkers. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I'm Sean Brittingham from Delmar. I am on the state board, January of 2021 and became the president in May. 2022, I believe, somewhere in that area. I think the first month you started working, appointed by Governor Carney, and now I'm here and I'm doing what I'm doing and I'm looking forward to working with you and Deb.
Okay, I'm Deb Stevens. I was appointed to the state board in 2022, but prior to that, I worked for the Delaware State Education Association for 32 years and was prior to that, a teacher in Massachusetts for 17 years. So a little bit of my background.
Yeah, look at you now.
Look at me now.
Reverend Powell.
All right, good evening. Reverend Proudly Powell Jr., it's a pleasure to meet you. Welcome to Delaware. I have been on this state board for, I guess, 6 years now, I believe. I'm probably the only oldest tenured member.
Yes.
Yes. And so I'm a retired Allstate insurance agent for 40 years, and I'm a pastor in a local church in Wilmington, Delaware called Mount Joy United Methodist Church. And I'm a former educator, so and I'm retired.
This is what retirement looks like.
That's what retirement looks like. Thank you.
Good evening, Dr. Martin. I'm Sage Sawney. I'm currently a senior at Cesar Rodney High School. I was appointed to the state board by Governor Carney in July of 2024, and I'm currently the student representative. I look forward to working with you in the future, and it was nice to see you last week at the Public Education Funding Commission meeting.
Good evening. I'm Jim Simmons. I was appointed to by Governor Carney in December of 2024. I am actually what retirement looks like because I just retired. So I have that fresh retired look. And in my former role, I worked in many meetings here. I just recently was the chief equity officer for the Department of Ed and longtime educator. And I'm from Wilmington, Delaware. Nice to meet you.
Wow, you just didn't skip a beat from retirement.
I tried just when I thought I was out.
Thank you for your service.
Meredith Griffin, I was appointed to the board a year ago in January by Governor Carney. Prior to joining the board in education, I served on the Christina School District's Board of Education, served as their president for a number of years on that board. And professionally, I am a local church pastor in Newcastle County, Delaware.
Hi, I'm Nisha Latavia. I was appointed by Governor Carney in July of 2024. So I'm newish. By training, I'm an epidemiologist biostatistician. I teach at the college level. I look forward to working with you. I specifically look forward to developing a collaborative relationship where we can align priorities and kind of get this moving.
Hi, I'm Megan Sabo. I'm the teacher representative on the board. I was the 2015 Delaware Teacher of the Year. I was a science teacher for many, many years. This is my 22nd year in education. Science teacher for a long time. Became science specialist at my district. Found that I missed being around the kids. So my district happened to be opening a new middle school right around that time. So now I am the assistant principal at that middle school. So yeah, kind of coming full circle.
Very nice. Thank you. Secretary Martin, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. I just keep pinching myself around all the people that I meet since I've come to this great state and the passion and the commitment that people have to education. It's truly remarkable. And I agree with what you're saying around, can we get alignment and do big things and do them together? And we have the answers in education. That's the crazy thing. You're epidemiologist. You understand data. You understand how to track progress and to know if what you're doing is working, and data really matters and people really matter because it's a people driven business. So I'm very, very passionate about this work, and I'm so honored to have been nominated by the governor, go through the confirmation process, and most importantly, to just get to work. Besides Sage, I haven't met very many students yet, and that's like too long for me to be far away from students because I am very clear on who I work for. Technically, I currently work for the governor of the great state of Delaware. We know that this is how these positions work. I always know who my boss is, but really, and Governor Meyer would say this too, we work for you, Sage, and your peers. The students of the state of Delaware are our bosses. That's who we work for, and we're trying to design equitable systems that work for not some students in some schools in some parts of the state on some days, but the systems that work for all students in all parts of the state in all classrooms every day. And that's my life's work. So that's a big value statement. And I know that trust is something that is earned. It's not given. I'm the new kid on the block coming in from out of state, out of town. But I'll tell you what I'm bringing with me. And I think our stories and our journey matters in the way that we do our work and the way we collaborate and build a trusting relationship. I first of all, thank you for your service. The fact that you have stepped up and said, I will lead, I will be part of a public meeting, I'll be part of a public process, I will be on the state board. You've accepted that charge. I have gratitude for that and a lot of respect for people who choose to lead during really challenging times, quite frankly. So this is my 36th year in education. Right out of college, went straight into teaching, and I knew I wanted to be a teacher since I was 5 years old. When people ask me, what do you do? Like if I meet a stranger on the train or something, oh, what do? I don't say I'm Secretary of Education or superintendent or some of these other titles I've had. I say I'm a teacher because that's what I think of myself as a teacher. I was trained to be a teacher, and I bring my teaching heart to everything that I do. As I move through different roles and levels of leadership, I was a classroom teacher for 17 years, not for a few minutes before going into administration. It was a long time, 17 years. And quite frankly, would have still been teaching kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade. I taught all elementary grades. My passion was literacy, teaching reading, writing, and creating a great writing classroom and professional development around literacy in all of my 17 years of teaching. And I say, if you teach kindergarten, you can do just about anything. The year that I taught kindergarten, my own son, who's 30 now, that gives you an idea how long ago that was. My own son was in kindergarten that year too. He wasn't in my class. He was in another class. So I had 28 kindergartners all day and then one more when I got home at night. So that was quite a year. It was a lot of fun. He was very jealous of the field trips I took my own kindergartners on, and he wanted to go on those field trips with me. So I bring all of these years of experience. After 17 years in the classroom, I had a principal who asked me if I would become the vice principal of the school. And I didn't want to. I said, no, I love teaching. Why would I leave the classroom? I really love teaching. But as it happened, I said, as long as I can still be involved in teaching and learning and instruction and supporting teachers to improve their practice, then I'll do it. And of course, I did recess lunch duty. It was a large school with 1,000 kids, pre-kindergarten through fifth grade. And if you think of 1,000 kids on an inner city campus in San Diego, it was 5 lunch periods. So I was on the lunch court for 2.5 hours, but I was also doing professional development and in the classroom, doing classroom observations, supporting teachers. And this was a low performing school in San Diego Unified School District, a school with 100% of the students qualify for Title I, which was free, not even reduced lunch. 85% of the students were identified as multilingual learners. San Diego is 15 minutes from the U.S.-Mexico border. So many of the students came from Tijuana or from Mexico, crossed the border, some crossed the border daily or on a regular basis. I considered that school, that was my 14th year of teaching. My first 7 years were in a private school. My second 7 years of teaching were in a suburban district with 50% Title I. Then I went to that inner city school. That was the one with 1,000 kids, pre-kindergarten through fifth grade, and every risk factor known to education existed on that campus. And I went to that school because I believed in the hope and promise of public education in our country. I believed that what I learned in my first 14 years of teaching could come to bear in a school that had every risk factor known to education, and I wanted to prove it. So I became a teacher there. The principal twisted my arm and asked me to become the vice principal, and I did. And I ended up spending 10 years at that school. It was a school that was being taken over by the state. The state of California had a process at the time where if you had a decline in test scores over time and other factors they looked at, you went into corrective action, and the state monitor was coming to shut you down. The school was being reconstituted. And that's when I got recruited, a teacher and then vice principal, and ultimately became the principal of the school. During the 10 years that I was at that school, we got out of corrective action in a year. That was not hard for me. Teaching kids how to read is not hard for me. Teach literacy, and that's my life's work and my background. But it's building sustainable, systemic work that is replicable and is scalable that I care most about. And so I spent 10 years doing that. We built a school garden. We built a school-based health center. We built an employee daycare when 7 of our teachers in 1 year all were having their own new babies. And I wanted them to be able to come back to work and not say no to their own child, to say yes to other people's children, but to do it all without, you know, giving up on themselves. And so we partnered with the YMCA and built an infant employee daycare. I'm trying to think of all the great things. We brought an arts program, a science lab, and just built what I knew to be like a beautiful school for kids that came from with every risk factor known to education. And I would have still been at Central Elementary if it weren't for, during that 10-year period, the Board of Education in San Diego Unified. It was a 5-member elected board. San Diego Unified is the second biggest district in the state of California with 100,000 kids and a $1.2 billion budget. From 2003 to 2013, when I was principal at that one school in this giant district, there were 200 schools. San Diego Unified had 7 superintendents. Every time I looked up, there was a new superintendent. 3 were permanent, 4 were interim, and the board contacted me and asked if I wanted to be the next superintendent. I was a principal at one of their 200 schools. I was not applying for the job. I didn't know the job was open. I wasn't trying to become the superintendent. That was getting me further away from what I love most, which is the classroom. But they said, we see what you've done at your school. They had adopted something called Vision 2020, which is to your point, they had a coherent common vision for the district, and they didn't see the district had made enough progress on it over a 10-year period with seven different superintendents. And they thought what I had been doing at my school and some of the schools in San Diego Unified were realizing the vision, but it wasn't coherent, it wasn't comprehensive, it wasn't across the district, and they thought I could help with that. So I became superintendent on July 1st, 2013, the same year that California implemented the local control funding formula, which is the weighted student formula that's an equity-based formula. And I took over the $1.2 billion budget with a $7 billion capital campaign and 16,000 staff, and was in it to prove and show that when a team works together with the board and the superintendent to support educators to have the supports they need, that you can, in fact, deliver on what I think is the hope and promise of public education in our country, where your demography does not determine your destiny. It turned into an 8-year project. It would have been longer. Our NAEP scores improved during that time. San Diego Unified, we'll get to NAEP scores soon, but San Diego Unified is a district who's part of the Trial Urban District Assessment Program. Normally, when you look at NAEP scores, you just see state-by-state comparison. You don't get to see district comparison. San Diego Unified voluntarily made their NAEP scores public so you could see how the district was doing, not just the whole state. And NAEP for San Diego had not been good for many years. And 2, 4, and 6 years into my superintendency, our scores changed direction and started going in the other direction. I'll get more into that later. I'm proud of the work that I did there, and I would have still been there. It's my home. I love San Diego. My mother's 86. She's still there. My brother's, his name is Charlie. He just turned 60. He's developmentally disabled. So my passion for students with disabilities comes from my brother and all of the work that I've seen be done on his behalf his whole life. But I said yes to President Biden when he asked if I would be his nominee for Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Education 4 years ago. That project ended at 11:59 a.m. on January 20th. But I was honored to serve in the Biden-Harris administration as the number two at the U.S. Department of Education. The deputy secretary, the Biden-Harris administration was looking for a teacher to go to the U.S. Department of Ed who also had management experience, who had run large systems and had understood how to use data to move the work. And so they found me because I was a unicorn because I had been a teacher and I had run a billion-dollar organization, and I had done it not for a few minutes, but for 8 years. And so I was confirmed by the U.S. Senate in May of 2021 and was honored to do that service. In the last 4 years, being able to see excellence across our country and how people have used the federal dollars to, I always say, to do better, not in spite of the federal government, but because of the support and the investment. And so that project ended. The work on supporting 50 states across the country is over. And now I get to put all of my energy, experience, passion, and expertise to use here in this great state. And I feel like everything I've done to this point has prepared me to be able to support Delaware in the way that you and your students deserve. And I am more inspired every day as I meet you and people around the state around what you all have been working on doing. Incredible efforts, coherence and alignment, and directing those efforts in a way that actually get the results. I'm here for it. And I had to call my mom and say, Mom, I'm not coming back to San Diego yet. I'm staying on the East Coast because there's work for me to do in Delaware. So I'm really honored. It's not time to, I'd say, put my tools in the shed and go home. It's time to use them. And I'm here to do that, not to just bring in outside answers from San Diego or Washington, D.C., but I also won't be quiet about experiences and things that I think might be helpful. And I want to be a part of the conversation. I'm honored to be here with all of you. Hope to make a difference.
Oh, you will. Well, thank you. Congratulations again and welcome. We look forward to working with you and your team to, again, as I say, to make Delaware number one. Thank you. All right, we're going to move on to the agenda. Wilmington Learning Collaborative updated this for information. Dr. Laura Burgos, Executive Director of the Wilmington Learning Collaborative, is here to present updates on the WLC's current progress and highlights. Dr. Burgos, thank you for coming.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. Again, my name is Dr. Laura Burgos. I serve as the first executive director of the Wilmington Learning Collaborative. We are a 501c3 nonprofit cross-district network of schools. We are made up of 9 schools spanning 3 districts throughout the city of Wilmington, and that includes the Red Clay Consolidated School District, the Christina School District, as well as the Brandywine School District. Just some background information. The Wilmington Learning Collaborative was an initiative led by current Mayor John Carney with the goal of creating consistency across city schools, City of Wilmington schools, increasing school-based decision-making and putting collaborative structures in place to reduce silos across schools. I'm going to move quickly through some of the updates. I will say the agreement to establish the Wilmington Collaborative was executed in November 2022. I entered the work back in August 2023. Since then, quite a bit has happened. We initiated our first teaching and learning analysis of the 9 schools last fall, which produced a set of opportunity scorecards, which really gave us a lens into the quality of instruction happening in our schools, the expectations had for our students, and how teachers and administrators were collaborating to drive instruction. Right now, one of our biggest efforts underway is the design and launch of our community councils. And this will be the first cross-district effort to create shared decision-making bodies that are centered on families and community members. We are working closely with our nonprofit partner, Children and Families First, to design the councils. And for those of you who have been following the work, those of you who may have attended our monthly WLC council meeting on Tuesday evening, I'm sure you also heard quite a bit about our teacher leader work. Can't seem to advance the slide, so perhaps someone could. Okay. The bulk of our work is really centered on 3 big shifts. And those big shifts are students first, purposeful partnerships, and connected schools. While simply put, the reason why we call them big shifts is because they require dramatic changes in our practice and in our mindsets. We want all of our decisions to be centered on students, advancing student outcomes, and simply not prioritizing adult comforts. We also want to better connect our schools. As you can imagine, with 9 different schools across 3 districts, there is a lot of difference in approaches to teaching literacy instruction, difference in curriculum, staffing structures, priorities. So our hope is as we continue to advance this work, we create more cohesion across our schools. And then finally, purposeful partnerships. We have many partners in the fold. We certainly see an opportunity to do a better job of linking, connecting our investments and efforts to outcomes. We want to make sure that we're identifying partners that are serving critical needs and that we can actually measure the efforts of their work. So our school partners, you'll see up there, we're going to move through that. So we have 4 Christina School District schools, and that includes the newly built Maurice Pritchett Senior Academy, the Byard School, and 2 of our early education centers, Stubbs and Pulaski. Those are our 4 Christina School District school partners. For our Red Clay Consolidated School partners, we have Johnson Elementary, Lewis Elementary, our dual language school, as well as Shortledge and Warner Elementary schools. And then finally, we have Harlan Elementary, our Brandywine school partner. One of many ways in which we engage our schools together is that we do hold monthly collaborative working sessions with all of our principals as well as our assistant principals. This gives us time to create a space where we can collaborate, problem solve. We engage in a lot of consultancy protocols and some design work. Some of our most recent conversations include the design and launch of a kinder camp this summer to better prepare our incoming kindergarten students. So one example of how we try to advance our collective mission is by making sure we're having consistent conversations across the schools. Some of our key initiatives this year, in addition to the community councils, some of the work that we're most proud about is what we call our educator pathways. We are a very lean team. We will eventually be a team of five. We are currently a team of three. You will find us on the ground quite often. And our biggest portfolio of work right now includes our educator supports. One piece of that work includes what we call our Teacher Leader Design Fellowship. So this is a cohort of nearly 40 teachers spanning not only our 9 WLC schools, but some of our charter partners, designed for several reasons. One, to create communities of practice across schools, expose our educators to job-embedded coaching. So each of our teacher leaders have a coach in the classrooms with them, working with them to strengthen practice. And then we also bring our teacher leaders around the country to look at innovative school models, to identify new teaching and teaching and learning solutions to pilot in their school communities. We're currently designing what phase two of this work will look like. But for those of you who joined us Tuesday night, we were able to hear from about five of our teacher leaders, very specific examples of how these efforts are shifting their practice. Another layer of support we provide to aspiring educators is something called the TAP program, and that stands for the Teacher Assessment Preparation Program. Early on, in hosting a number of focus groups and interviews with our school-based staff, we learned that we had many subgroups of aspiring educators and current educators in the building. And we certainly saw an opportunity to do a better job in supporting everyone on advancing through their journey. One of those journeys included making sure we have as many certified teachers as possible in our schools. We launched this pilot program last summer by simply putting out the call to see who would like to engage in some virtual and in-person tutoring and coaching in preparation for the praxis. We received an overwhelming response, so that turned into a fall series. We launched a very small cohort of approximately 23 aspiring educators who would meet every Wednesday night in our offices, and we are located in the DSU Riverfront Building in downtown Wilmington. We would meet from 4:30 to 7:30 in partnership with Delaware State University and an organization called Your Teacher Tutors. We would provide on-site coaching support and praxis preparation. We know in order to better support our educators, we need to remove all barriers. So we also provided on-site childcare, including meals for children. We wanted to make sure that our educators could focus on the work and on preparing to successfully pass the praxis. Another layer of work that we recently launched earlier this winter is the College Unbound program. We also noticed that we have quite a few community members and adults in our building serving children who would benefit, of course, from completing their college coursework. So we're currently working with a small group to complete their bachelor's degrees and transition into ARTC programs. That's some of the most exciting work that we're doing, and we see nothing but opportunity to continue to scale it, but also thinking about other subgroups of educators that we can better serve next year. We do partner with the departments and a partner organization called Learning Focused and conducting monthly DTGSS learning walks. These are opportunities to build the capacity of our school leaders and really narrowing down their focus and coaching up our educators. We're very excited about that continued work, and we're in talks about planning for next year currently to make sure all 9 WLC schools are participating full-time in the effort. Leadership pipeline, we are currently undergoing a national search for two of our principal positions, and these are our two largest schools. We see an opportunity to really reimagine how we select school leaders, not simply posting the position and making decisions based on availability and familiarity, but really using a competency-based selection model. Before we reposted both positions, we held a number of community-based focus groups, including student focus groups, family focus groups, teacher focus groups. We wanted to make sure that the postings for each position reflected the values and aspirations of the school communities. We are heading into round two. We have quite a selection of candidates, and we're excited to make these decisions in collaboration with the school community, WLC working side by side with the Christina School District and the ALMA Advisory Group, a national executive search firm with years of experience placing senior level education leaders in both school systems and nonprofits around the country. And finally, and we certainly should have led with this work, each of the 9 WLC schools has what we call an educator leader team, the ELTs. We're ramping up for our spring convening, and what the ELTs embody are truly the spirit of school-based decision-making. These groups are made up of teachers, paraprofessionals, school administrators, and others of staff members, and they come together weekly, bi-weekly, to really think about solutions, examining data, thinking about how to advance the work. They're able, they do have access to funding and resources from the WLC to launch pilot solutions, including expanded learning time, curriculum supports, and you'll be hearing more and more about some of their efforts as they continue to build upon the work. We do opportunity we provide to bring our 9 school partners together is something called the ELT convening. We began in July. We hosted a fall October convening at the Delaware Art Museum, and we have our next ELT convening coming up on April 5th at the Hyatt Riverfront. And these are spaces for ELT teams to come and showcase their work and gather critical professional learning. Something we highlighted and focused on during the last convening was managing team conflict. So many of our educator leader team members were able to complete the Thomas Kilman instrument, which is designed to better understand your individual approach to managing conflict and how it impacts others. We're looking forward to our April convening to getting updates on the work happening and building some capacity around both project management and progress monitoring. We could advance to the last slide. We can continue. I covered much of this. Right. With that being said, I can certainly go on and on. This is critical work. I'm about a year and a half in. Much work to do, but some of the most important highlights I want you to walk away with tonight is that we are reducing silos across school communities. We are bringing schools together. We're creating collaborative spaces amongst educators and leaders. We know this is not the end all be all. We have a lot of work to do, but we're certainly committed to this work for the long run. And thank you for your support.
Any questions from the board members?
I have one question. I'm curious about your initiatives that you have. I think they're all great. I'm just wondering, how are they funded?
We're completely state funding. Okay. So we have a $10 million allocation for this year, and we also were able to carry over unspent funds from last year.
That was a couple of questions. My first question, what is the formal, how is the relationship between WLC and the districts formalized? What is the actual relationship with the districts?
So according to the MOU, the districts retain ultimate authority over their school, over their schools. The WLC, and I report to the WLC Council, which is made up of the 3 district superintendents, 3 board members, parent representatives, and then 2 appointed roles, including a retired educator and a mayoral appointee. So the relationship is that the WLC is afforded the opportunity to make certain decisions for each school, and of course, in collaboration with district leaders. It's complicated, as you can imagine. But we've been able to foster positive relationships with each of the district level teams. I meet with the three superintendents regularly. That is something that started from the onset. We knew in order to do this work, we had to be on the same page. The WLC had to understand district priorities, and the WLC also had to advocate for space to pilot new solutions and take some risks. It's a constant work in progress.
Second question, I noticed that PS DuPont was excluded from the list of WLC schools. What led to that decision, and how has that affected kind of the dynamic of this as a Bloomington Learning Collaborative?
Great question. Those decisions were made before I stepped into the role. So I don't have the quite a depth of information. It would be a conversation to have with the Brandywine School District. We haven't approached that conversation, or we haven't, heard any, feedback. Districts do have, per the MOU, the ability to work with their boards to add or remove schools. We haven't formalized what that looks like, but it is written in the MOU. Some other highlights from the MOU is that we have a responsibility to find ways to support all students living in the city of Wilmington, not solely those attending WLC schools. So when we launch initiatives to support educators, we also open them up to our charter school partners. We know many of our students attend those schools as well.
Are the MOUs formalized with each district individually?
There's one MOU that all three district school boards signed off on. And
thank you.
You're welcome.
I've got a question. Thank you for coming this evening. I was so glad to hear about your team building efforts, because so often we expect people to operate as a team, but we don't take the time to help people understand what a team is and how to build one. What I'm interested in is, are your ELTs, and I know they're relatively newly formed, have they dealt with the school plans yet? Because I know a number of the schools were either previously identified as either CSI or TSI schools, which brought with it developed plans that were developed in coordination with the department. Have the ELTs reviewed those plans and adapted them in any way yet, or is it still too early?
Well, the way we treat the school plans, and I will say that each district takes a different approach. For example, the Christina School District has what they call their leadership priority plans. Red Clay has their continuous improvement plans. What we did to create a common language is, in meeting with the school leaders monthly, we created school improvement snapshots. And we focus down on specific literacy and math outcomes to give us a common language. So the ELTs do center their work on the school plans, and any effort or initiative that they propose, and I could talk a little bit about how we fund those initiatives, there is an application process that we run. Anything that they propose has to be aligned with the school plan. So for example, I'll give you a short story. So we have something called the ELT Innovation Fund. So each school has access to a pool of funds, and it's distributed equitably based on project, based on idea. And so in order to access those funds, they have to submit a project plan. They have to submit a clear plan around, what's the problem or dilemma they're trying to respond to, what outcomes would this solution advance according to the school plan, what are the phases of the work, what are the resources needed, and they also have to submit a budget. We provide technical assistance, both from our team and also some of our nonprofit partners. We sit in on meetings, we help facilitate. It looks different by school. Every ELT is in a different place. Some hit the ground running and within the first few months, already had a few proposals on the table. Others are taking, a little bit longer to be more thoughtful. I always encourage, thinking big, multi-year initiatives rather than, one-time tangible things. We saw Harlan, adopt a new approach to progress monitoring when it came to their youngest learners and mathematics. And some of that work then spread throughout the larger school district. And that's the hope, that we pilot solutions that schools can learn from one another, but that it also spans outside the WLC. Another way schools access WLC funds is through school leaders, requesting support for various efforts. We have both a programmatic budget and an operational budget. We manage our own operational budget, which is much smaller. The programmatic budget is managed by the three school districts. We work closely with their chief financial officers. So we, you know, transfer funds for specific bodies of work from the state to each district. We fund positions. For example, at Pulaski, we saw that kindergarten classroom sizes last year were too big and that there was additional support needed. So we funded paraprofessional positions. We're very careful and thoughtful. We know that funding a position requires careful consideration because we want to allow for consistency, and we would never want to fund a set of positions that we could not maintain, you know, for the future. And the goal of the ELT decision making, you know, I say this all the time, that the goal is to not create a project and for us to approve it based on whether we like it or not. My goal is to help them get it off the ground and support them and remove barriers and to truly respect the decisions made by those closest to teaching and learning. So it's, as always, you know, an iteration, a work in progress. We enjoy our convenings. Many, you know, we were, of course, advised not to gather on Saturdays or not to gather in the evenings. It's hard for people to get together. But we've done a good job with messaging and removing barriers. So typically we have approximately 45, 50 educators showing up on a Saturday morning to our ELT convening. We try to provide childcare care and activities for the kids so that that removes some barriers. It's not perfect, but I think if we continue to be creative and learn from, you know, what's working, what isn't working, and communicate the challenges, communicate the wins, that we'll continue to break down some of those silos. Our teacher leaders, they visited several DC public schools and charter schools last week, took a quick day trip. And they came back, of course, with all sorts of ideas. And now they work with their coaches to think about, you know, what did they see that they could really learn from? The goal not being to replicate what we see elsewhere, but to think more critically around our practice. And the more exposure, the better. So our next community of practice, you know, we'll keep them on our website. Our teacher leaders do gather in the evenings. Any given time, you'll see them tinkering with math manipulatives and thinking of new ways to execute objectives for students. So it's amazing work, and it's definitely the work that we're most proud of.
Thank you. Once again, thank you for coming tonight, and it's good to see you again, Mrs. Anderson. If you recall, we met by Zoom with our consultant, Kathy Denhart, several months ago, and we shared with you a lot of our successes that we had when we deployed these learning labs in the city of Wilmington post-COVID to support communities around the city of Wilmington, one in Southbridge, one on the east side, and one on the west side. We have partnered with the United Way of funding. We had utilized highly qualified instruction material, one-on-one tutors, and we really gained a lot of proficiencies in reading and math during the after-school programs and summer programs. Funding dried up, and we were not able to sustain that level of impact. One of the things, I guess you talked about community councils. I don't know if you would give me the advice as we go back to the table as a community. I pastor in Southbridge, Southbridge and Wilmington. Our school was closed, Upper Palmer. And so a lot of the school students are either going to Orange Pritchett or charter schools or all over. Our challenge in the community, from a community-based perspective, is try to bring a commitment to education from the community perspective, not just from the school. So with all the different parents going to different schools and charters, it's hard for us to really get a gauge or a handle on really identifying maybe assets in our community. How do we go? How would you suggest that we go to the table and now develop a plan and a strategy to focus on our community and raise the proficiencies, engage parents, and really make an impact in our community? So that's, I don't know if that's a part of the community councils that we reform, but we've had collaborations already set up. We just really at the table at the Southbridge now, we're impacting what we call the SNAP plan, Southbridge Neighborhood Action Plan. It's a 10-year plan of the areas that things that need to be done in our community, and one is youth and one is education. So we have a workshop coming up soon. I would love to hear your recommendation of how we can kind of really like partner with you and or either Reading Consortium to get this up off the ground.
Yeah, I definitely think we, I've been in conversation with, of course, the United Way as we think about advancing literacy, third grade reading outcomes, as well as summer learning. I do think that the community councils will be the game changer. They've already started meeting and they have their first 9 school cross council convening coming up late March. I think that could be a pivotal moment to work with ourselves and Children Families First to perhaps message some of that work. You know, not sure how many families are familiar with the SNAP plan, but I think that's going to be the vehicle driving community connectedness in each school. We want to move away from these isolated efforts, these, you know, one-off dinners and events, which all need to happen, but cannot be the end-all be-all. We also want to shift the focus from simply dictating what parents and families need to do better to the focus on us. What conditions do we need to create to foster those healthy, authentic, sustainable relationships? So I think you and I need a conversation, and we certainly need you to need to connect you to our CFF partners.
Thank you so much. I know you've been on a lot of heavy lifting, and we're really looking forward to you coming and sharing with us. One of the recommendations also was to have a community education ambassador in the particular community so that they can navigate through all the nuances from different districts, so that there's a one central place that parents, I was at a groundbreaking ceremony day at St. Kofa in South Britt, 5 new single family female households, different schools, and we're talking, and they didn't know where to be the pattern one. So we had a ambassador in that community that's connected to all the schools, connected to the Department of Education, connected to Wilmington Learning Collaborative, the Reading Consortium, the City of Wilmington. They really kind of navigate for the parents. I think that would probably help to lift the community up. So I would offer that as a thought or a suggestion, and maybe we could maybe develop that. At least in our community for a pilot or something and replicate that around the community. So that's just, thank you for this opportunity to share. It's been on my heart. Kathleen knows it's been a suggestion of mine for a long time. So just
Yes. And with the Wilmington City Council's launch of the Office of Educational Advocacy, I see a lot of opportunity for us to align efforts and deepen that work. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time.
There isn't anything else. Thank you. What you're doing is amazing. To work with 3 different school districts and to blend the City of Wilmington into one, I applaud you. I don't know how you do it, but best of luck. And we look forward to your continued success and like to hear from you again.
Thank you. Thank you. I look forward to it.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Okay, next on the agenda, Delaware NAP results. This is for information. Dr. April McCray, Director of Assessment and Accountability, is here with us to present information on Delaware's recent NAP scores. Dr. McCray, hey, welcome.
Hi. Nice to be with you this evening.
As so, we agree with you.
It's a long way away.
There's a reason. Give me a good running start.
I'm just waiting for things to show up on the screen. Is this not working this evening? Yes, it is. I don't know if that was me or him. So thank you very much for your time this evening. I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking with you about the NAEP results for Delaware. My name is April McCray. I am the director of the Office of Assessment and Accountability in the state of Delaware. Before I actually get started with the actual results, I'd like to take just a few minutes to talk about NAEP itself and make sure that we're all level setted on exactly what NAEP is as an assessment, who it assesses, and what the results really are telling us. So if you would bear with me on that front, let's see. Nope, it wasn't me. Or maybe it was, I don't know. So NAEP is the only assessment that measures what students know and can do in various subjects across the country that is actually comparable across jurisdictions in the United States. It's actually an assessment that's overseen by the National Assessment Governing Board, which is a group of curriculum, instruction, assessment, and policy experts that take into consideration all of our state standards as well as international standards across the country and across the world to make that determination of what students should know and be able to do and to create the benchmark and framework for the assessment. So while we have our state assessment, which is based specifically on Delaware state standards, NAEP is very similar to that assessment, but it also takes into the consideration some of those things that may go above and beyond that. The state assessment that we give is very similar in terms of trends and longitudinal information that we get. So we can feel very confident in the state of Delaware that the information that we get from Smarter Balance on an annual basis is giving us the kind of information that we will be also seeing when we get our NAEP results every other year. So NAEP is actually given every 2 years. We get our Smarter Balance assessment every year. So NAEP is actually given to a stratified proportional sampling of students from across each state or each jurisdiction to provide a data resource representative of the overall population of the demographics within our state. And I'll talk about a little more about that in the next slide. But basically, it's a sample of our students, not all of our students. So again, Smarter Balance we give to all of our students across the state. Every single student in the state takes that assessment. With NAEP, it's actually a much smaller population that's just representative of all of our students. The assessment is the only assessment that does give us, again, that comparability across jurisdictions because it is measuring the same thing for all students from state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So I just really quickly want to make sure that that's clear because when we give Smarter Balance, it's based on our state standards that are specific to us. When another state gives their state test, it's based on their state standards and the scale and portions and information that they're measuring in their state. And it might be slightly different. Now they might give similar trends and information for, but I cannot compare Delaware state scores on Smarter Balance to Pennsylvania state score on their tests, to Virginia state scores on their tests. They're measuring different things about their students. And sometimes those state tests are norm referenced, whereas ours is criterion referenced, so it's a different measure. NAEP is the same test for every jurisdiction. So we're actually able to look from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and kind of see how our students are doing across the country. And it's the only assessment that allows us to do that. So when I talk about that jurisdiction level comparison, what I'm talking about are all 50 states, the Department of Defense, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and 27 urban districts. And I want to be clear that those urban districts are not like Wilmington. The urban districts are very large. For instance, the district that our new secretary comes from had a population that was about the same population as the entire state of Delaware. So we will not be able to get district level data in the state of Delaware because our populations in our districts are so small that we won't be able to get those kinds of information from this from this test. But there are some large urban districts that are able to do that.
The 27 large urbans that have agreed to be part of that trial urban district, like San Diego agreed, they're part of a network called the Council of Great City Schools, which is the 72 large urbans in the country, over 100,000 students in the district. And there's not a district in the state of Delaware that is a part of the Council of Great City Schools. There could be. The Council of Great City Schools says you're supposed to be a certain size district to be a member of that group, or whatever the biggest district in the state is, could be a member of Council Great City Schools. They couldn't be in the trial urban district though, because it wouldn't be a large enough. But those 20 of the 70 large urban districts in the country, 27 of them, a number of years ago, it's been over a decade now, which I argue, why did they call it trial? Because it's not a trial anymore. We've done it for a long time, but at the beginning it was unmasked those scores. That's why sometimes you get district level data from a voluntary group of 27 of the large urbans.
Right. So just to give an example of the types of sample sizes that are assessed across the country. So across the country, a national public sample size at grade four approximately 5,700 schools are sampled across the United States. That's about 112,000 total students at grade four in mathematics and similar for grade four in reading. At grade eight, there's about 5,100 schools that are assessed and about 111,000 students, and it's similar for reading at grade eight. So it's a small population of students across the country, but again, they are sample sizes, and I'll explain more on the next slide. So in Delaware, a grade four math sample is approximately 17% of our total grade four population. So we have about 10,000 total students at grade four in the state of Delaware. NAEP is going to sample about 1,700 of those students. And let me give you an example of the 10,000 students that we have in grade four in Delaware. About 21% of those students are special ed. About 15% are English language learners, 51% are male, 48% are female. I'm not going to quiz you on these numbers. I'm just giving you some examples of these subgroups. When NAEP does the sampling of the 1,700 students, they ensure that the proportions of students that are in that 1,700 student population are the same proportions as would be across the 10,000 student population. So they ensure that 21% of the 1,700 students are special ed. 51% are male, 48% are female, and so on. Does that make sense?
Representative sample of the population of fourth graders currently enrolled in Delaware of the year of the test, which is every 2 years. I thought that was really important when April was putting this together, that you saw some people think it's like every kid in the state is tested or it's every fourth grader and parents here see the test results and we're not first, we're almost last. And what does that mean? I wanted this body to know it's a sampling. It's a statistically meaningful and relevant, correct sampling, but it's not every student in the state. SBAC is every student, every grade level.
So how are the schools and or students chosen?
Generally, it's a random sampling. So they put the information into the computer and they basically do a computerized lottery sampling, but ensuring that within that lottery sampling that they're meeting the proportions that are necessary to ensure the appropriate numerics.
And then we notify them.
And then we notify them.
These are the kids that are taking it. Correct. When I was superintendent in San Diego, we would get the letter saying, here are the schools we picked and here are the students at the school. The statisticians from the NAEP governing body and NES, which is the Federal Department of Education, sends the sample group based on their ed statisticians selecting the sample group that's representative of the state population. So then you send the letter to the principal and say, congratulations, you won. You get to get promotions.
That is correct. It's always a fun conversation. Yes.
Is the subset of low income identified?
Yes. So the for fourth grade in the state of Delaware, 28% of that 10,000 student population is economically disadvantaged. Across the entire
state. 1,700 that take it.
So, and that's just in fourth grade. So the same thing is done for eighth grade. Correct. Yeah.
Isn't this fascinating?
And they purposefully do this so they don't want us to know what students they're choosing. They don't want us to know what schools they're choosing until the last minute. This is purposefully done. It's very scientific in nature to ensure that they're getting this random proportional sampling and that they're choosing these students in such a way that we can't have input into the outcome, right?
What is the lead time? How far in advance of taking the test are they notified?
So we're actually coming into the cycle. So we'll be able to tell the schools which ones they are, but they don't actually find out which students are going to be tested until a few weeks before they're actually assessed.
So they deploy a team of people to conduct the assessment. It's not the school.
We don't do it.
It's a team from handling all the devices, best contractors from NAEP coming in for the assessment.
That's correct. Yeah.
So, just to make this clear, we'll say eighth graders. I think you had 1,100, 1,700. I don't know. Yeah. So we'll go to Del Mar. We have 100 eighth graders. Mm-hmm. Not all of them take it. It's just a random draw.
You might only have 15. Let's say Del Mar was chosen. You might only have 15 students in your school. Another school might have 25. Another school might have 30.
Fascinating. I thought everybody.
No, not at all.
All right.
What about charter schools? What
charter schools are also, I did not actually check to find out the percentage of charter schools. It's different every time. But we do have charter schools. What do you have?
All of them, every time.
I'm
texting them all right now.
Okay.
They all told me this morning. I'm not going to call. Yes, Karen.
It isn't all of them every time, but I'm sure every it's a large, school. I'm every, sure it's a large proportion of them.
Right. Every school, but not every student.
Right. Right. So we, in this past administration, we gave the assessment between January and March. It was administered digitally on tablets. Each student is only assessed on one subject. So when you saw those 1,700 students, it wasn't the same 1,700 that took the math as the reading in fourth grade. So they were separate students. Students only get a small portion of the item pool. They get the same blueprint. Basically, they're seeing different items on the test. So you're not seeing the same that she's seeing. And accommodations are provided as necessary for students with disabilities and English language learners. So we get the results, which you'll see soon, in two ways. We get scale scores, which are scaled between 0 and 500 on both the mathematics and reading assessments. And I do want to be clear that we do not compare across grade levels or content areas. So we don't say Delaware's reading score for NAEP was. We don't combine fourth and eighth grade for NAEP. It's the fourth grade reading or the eighth grade reading. We can't combine them. They are separate tests measuring separate things with separate students. And we also don't say overall NAEP scores in Delaware were. We might talk about trends in that, but we do not combine all of those scores. And then also the achievement levels are reported, and they're very similar to what we report for Smarter Balance. They are below NAEP Basic, NAEP Basic, NAEP Proficient, and NAEP Advanced. So when we look to see, just to ensure that our trends remain similar and that we can have confidence that Smarter Balance and NAEP are continuing to give us consistent reports, we can compare the proficiency rates for both of them together. And we notice over time that the trend lines are continuing to mirror one another year over year. So any questions on that before we get into the results that are already showing on the screen?
Not from me.
Okay. All right. So starting out with grade four mathematics, you can see that Delaware's grade four mathematics average score was 233, which was up 7 points from 2022. That is significantly, statistically significant. The NAEP public score was up, or was 237, which was up 2 points from 2022. Slide. If you look to our achievement level percentages in 2024, our NAEP proficient percentages were up by 6% and our NAEP advanced was up by 4%. This means that 35% of our Delaware tested students scored a 249 or higher on the NAEP assessment. The NAEP public average was 237. Delaware's overall average was 233.
This is really important slide, and it's not when you get the soundbite newspaper headlines about, you know, number 48 in the country. Some reporters do drill down to these proficiency levels, but to see that NAEP below basic went 36%, is it 36%? That's a percent, right?
Yes.
36% of the students 29. In 2022 were below basic, and the next year, 29%. Right. You want to see that. You want to see more advanced. Mm-hmm. And so 8% made it to advanced versus the year before only 4% were advanced. Since my life's work is around equity and figuring out how to help our most vulnerable students make progress, I'm always looking at did the high performing students more still stay high performing, or did we start to close the gap? When you're talking about closing achievement gaps, I think they're opportunity gaps. We can debate the terms later, but I'm always looking at who is actually making the change, who's making the movement, what made us 48th, and are we seeing our most vulnerable challenged students actually making progress there? So that, when you break it down like that, that's movement that I like to see.
April, I do have a question. It's interesting to look at the data that came in at 2003 versus where we are at 2024, and I'm wondering, there was a lot of change in state assessments and, you know, Common Core, you know, the standards changed. Has the NAEP test itself changed from 2003 to 2024, reflecting any of the changes that we've seen at the federal and state levels?
There have been some minor adjustments to the framework, yes. Not major adjustments. So the way the National Assessment Governing Board works, they do adjust the framework over time based on research and analysis of the standards and such. I think the most significant adjustment was done between 11 and 15, but it wasn't to the extent that it changed the scoring to any major change to create drifts one way or the other in terms of the results of the assessment. So this slide actually breaks down the subgroups, the student subgroups, and illustrates the growth or changes between the results of students from 2022, thank you, between 2022 and 2024 for our students in each of those areas against the national public. You'll see that our students in grade four for mathematics increased in all of the subgroups and at a significantly different rate than national public in a positive way. So the national public average was 237. You can see that 9 jurisdictions scored higher than this, 30 scored about the same, 14 scored less than 237 on average. Delaware was among the 14 lower scoring districts, but keeping in mind that there was a dramatic difference between last year's score and this year's score. So, you know, movement in a positive direction is what we want to see. The range of scores across the country was 2024 to 246, I'm sorry, and Delaware's average was 233. Right. Moving on to grade 8. Grade 8 mathematics, students scored an average of 263, which was down 1 point from last year. That is not considered statistically significant, but it was down 1 point. National public was also down 1 point from last year. Achievement level percentages were generally the same as last year. You do see that there is a 1% increase in NAEP advanced score since 2024. So that is something positive in our favor. Again, these scores are almost the same. This is not considered a statistically significant change from last year. So even between national public and Delaware, you're pretty much seeing a status quo since not last year, but since 2022. And again, you can see that our subscore changes are generally mirroring what's happening at national public. I did provide for you at the request of Dr. Ladhavia some more specific scores on this. For those of you who want to see, there are student group scores for each of the grade levels from 22 to 24 compared with national public for each of these subscores if you want to take a look at those. And then, as you can see, the overall was 272 with 22 districts or jurisdictions scoring higher, 11 scoring lower, or 11 scoring the same and 20 scoring lower. The range was 256 to 282. Delaware's average score was 263. Yes, now we're going to reading.
So can I just ask a quick question? Yes. So you collect, your department collects all of this information, and then what happens to it? Because I feel like this is really good information, and clearly you're able to pare it down to, you know, stratify it by race, you know, gender, whatever it is. So what happens with all of this?
So my office collects all of this information. What we like to do is share it with our Office of Curriculum Instruction Professional Development. And there's a lot of things that we do with it. First thing we do is ask more questions. So we get all of this data and you see it as it is there. That is not the end of the amount of breaking down of the data that we do. So more of the data breakdown that we will do is look across our subpopulations even more so and break them down within those populations. So for instance, there's crossover between male and female populations and other subgroups, obviously males who are, females who are, low socioeconomic who are, low socioeconomic who are not, and all of those sorts of things so that we can break all of those sorts of things down and see if there are any trends within any of those populations. From there, we can actually start to ask questions and look to see, are there changes within the achievement gaps that we're noticing? Is there a growth in the achievement gap in any of these areas? Is there something that we're noticing over time? One of the things that NAEP has broken down over at the national level that is not different necessarily for Delaware or any other state for that matter, is that students who are economically disadvantaged, the achievement gap there is actually widening again. So it was there was a significant closure over a period of time, and it's starting to widen again, generally after COVID. And so the question there becomes, like, is there overlap between students of low socioeconomic status at the highest end of performance and students who are not socioeconomically disadvantaged at the lowest end of their performance? Is there overlap there, or is there a complete divergence between them? And what does that mean? And how can we support folks in that area? And then, of course, I'm going to share that information with Secretary Martin, and then we'll make organizational decisions about how we can best support schools and communities in supporting our students in the best way possible to make their school experience as holistic as possible to help them to have the best educational experience as possible.
So generally speaking, that information, after you look at the data in different ways, trickles down to the school and informs curriculum in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely, yeah.
When you talk about big scale tests like these are lagging indicators. So yes. The NAEP test is the biggest lagging indicator that we have. And I'm comparing a lagging indicator to a leading indicator. They're assessments of learning versus assessments for learning. Mm-hmm. The closer the assessment is to the student, the more meaningful and valuable it is for that student's learning. Further away you get, this is not actionable data for a teacher. It's almost not actionable for a school or a principal, maybe for a superintendent, but even the superintendent doesn't have it disaggregated. This is large scale data that, which is most meaningful actually at the state level, because then we look at our investments, our supports, and that's why I look at when it's stratified, when it's broken down, are our results based on the below basic kids, that group got bigger, the advanced group got smaller, the advanced group got bigger. Where do we need to target when we put systems of support in place, right, when we do investments, when we recommend a state budget? Where does money need to go? And can you follow the investment to an outcome on a large scale mm-hmm. assessment? It is not meaningful to a classroom teacher. There's nothing actionable, a large scale lagging indicator, but what's actionable, and Delaware is fortunate in this case, is that the SBAC scores are indicative of the NAEP scores, luckily. In some states, they're not. In some states, their state assessment is not totally aligned or correlated to how they do on NAEP, so you can't know. This, because the state test is a little closer to the student. You can at least get that broken down by school and by district. You can get that broken down by student. I'll still argue the state test is still pretty far away from the student. It's the daily assessments. It's the ongoing assessments. It's the quarterly measures. It's the things that teachers give on a daily, weekly, end of unit assessments. When those line up and you can get movement on the classroom-based assessments that are assessments for learning that let you redo we need more high dosage tutoring, we need more after school, we need to double dose the student on reading instruction, we need to you can drill it down. When you get those classroom school-based assessments to move and you can monitor those quarterly, movement on those in an aligned, coherent assessment system creates movement on the SBAC, creates movement on the NAEP. But you're not going to move NAEP by changing your math lesson tomorrow, because you don't know on NAEP happened.
Right.
But an aligned, coherent assessment system with good, strong leading indicators, when those move, I promise you the other stuff moves, and the teachers have to worry about, I don't know if this is going to help NAEP or not. They don't need to worry about that. We build the designs and the supports, but that's a backwards design, and make sure your leading indicators that you're collecting at the school and building level, and then designing interventions. If you can do that quarterly, these tests are like autopsies. It's too late to do anything about it. That's a gross analogy, I'm sorry. But it's after the fact. It's like, well, okay, now what am I supposed to do? I wanna know before there's a heart attack. I wanna know before there's a problem. And that's why classroom-based quarterly assessments, at the beginning of the year, assess the whole class, assess the whole school, where are they? And the kids that are far below basic, proficient, advanced, the ones that are below basic on this leading indicator, I do something about it from September to December. Assess again in December. If what you didn't work and they're still below basic, change.
then do it again, January to April. And then when you see those moving, then you see the other things moving. That's like my fastest way of explaining an Alliant coherent Alliant system. Because you asked another question, like, what's actionable here?
Yeah. Well, the problem is, right. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I totally get it. The problem is you have like the media, like the New York Times article that came out last week that basically said Delaware is one of 10 states that had the greatest learning loss. I mean, right. So, and they're basing that off the NAEP test.
Yes. You want to talk about where that assessment came from?
Well, yeah, they were actually referring to a report that is not necessarily based on NAEP. They were, it's an extrapolation from NAEP. So they were referring to something called the Educational Recovery Report, which is pulled together by some senators at the national level, where they've asked to be able to compare districts and states to one another using state data, which I just explained to you really can't do, but because they asked really loudly to do so, what they did was what we call a linking study. So they took all of our state data from public sources, our website, which also includes some issues where we actually suppress some of our data based on, we want to make sure that our sample sizes are correct, and we also want to ensure student privacy. And so some of our data is suppressed. So not all of our data is available on our public website, but that's where the initial information comes from based on our Smarter Balance scores. Those scores were then incorporated into what's called a linking study in order to put those scores onto the NAEP scale. It didn't change what the test tested. It changed what the scores were onto a new scale. So they did the exact same thing to Virginia and Pennsylvania and all the other, they didn't change what the tests tested. They just changed what the scores were. And then that in that way, they were able to say, well, we can compare the scores because the scores are all on the same scale. They all measure Celsius, for instance, instead of Fahrenheit, but it didn't change what the tests tested. Right. And so it, you know, now that doesn't mean that the trends that they were describing overall for the state of Delaware were completely wrong, but there is some inconsistency in the information that was relayed in that particular report.
It does make for a good article, though.
Mm-hmm. It does.
And they were trying to solve the problem of how do we compare state to state. Everybody wants to know apples to apples. And the only way they can do it is try to extrapolate state data into a scaled score. So then they could compare it. Like the methodology is correct methodology. I followed it when I looked at the U.S. Department of Education. I asked the same question about what's the methodology that went into. I'm not questioning. I just want people to understand how that sentence could be true, what went into it. And she just did like a way better job than I could have explaining it and staying neutral. But we're not having an opinion about it. We just want you to know the facts about it.
Secretary Martin, would you just explain, you lived it, we could just feel it flowing from you. So you really broke it down, and if you could put that in layman's terms, interpret it down the road so that the lay person could really understand. I got it when you just said that. But if you can kind of put it in a narrative where the average person, a parent, educator can understand that down the road, I think that would be so helpful.
That's what I love to do. I'm a teacher. Like I said, I still say I'm a teacher.
Please feel free to invite us to some of your community programs because, you know, be happy to share.
Great, welcome and help.
So for the sake of time, we'll go ahead and go through the rest of these because I know you have a full agenda for the rest of the evening. So for grade 4 reading scores, this is also generally good news, overall. The average scale score was 210, which is up 2 points. The nation actually went down 2 points in fourth grade reading. So this was good news for Delaware. Next slide. We saw a 1% increase in NAEP proficient scores. 26% of our students actually tested at a score level of 238 or higher. National public was 214. So this does, again, illustrate that across all of our subgroups, our students were moving in the upward direction across the nation. A majority of students were actually moving in the opposite direction. So again, this is not necessarily bad news. We want to be doing better, but this is you know, moving in the right direction.
It's heading in the right direction. I'm still lower than it's ever been before, but at least it's right. Moving and it's moving more
in the right direction.
Last round.
Right. And so again, this just generally tells us what the jurisdictions are doing across the country. The average range of scores was 200 to 224. Delaware's average score was 210. So grade 8 reading results. Grade 8 reading results was a decrease of 4 points from 200 or from 2022. The national public average was 257, which was also a drop of 2 points from 2022. So you can see that there was a drop both in national public and in Delaware. Achievement level percentages for grade 8 remain just about the same as 2022, with a 1% decrease in NAEP advanced scores. 23% of our students scored at a 281. The national public average was 257.
And that below NAEP basic. 41% is the lowest
yes
it's ever been. And that's yes, a great concern. But we don't see a lot in the advance, but we've never seen a lot in advance. It's always been between 2 and 4%. But that has been, that's higher than it's been a long time, the last 2 years. So that's there's work to do, but we know how to do it. This is what I always say is a great thing in education. In epidemiology, I would imagine there are some things in childhood or medicine where we don't have answers or cures. In education, we do know some places, some days, some classrooms have figured out how to help the most challenging students achieve and achieve to their potential. And the degree to which it's not everybody. I've said this before, my grandmother's from Wisconsin and she grew up on a farm and they used to say that the farmers never blamed the corn and the corn wasn't growing. In a school example, when students aren't learning, our children are brilliant. Our children do know are able to learn, but they need different supports. And when there's greater need, there needs to be greater support or differentiated support. So I don't like to admire the problem and just look at it and wring my hands and clutch my pearls and, well, what are we going to do now? We know what to do. We have examples. We have models. How do we do it at scale? How can we be systemic about it in a systematic way? And so that's the work before us. But I look at that and say, okay, now your question earlier, now I know what to do. At the state level, if it was different, you know, where's the focus? Well, moving that subgroup is different than moving a proficient subgroup. All subgroups need to move and move to their potential, but the strategies are different depending on where they are and how far behind they are.
So in grade 8, there are a couple of spaces in asking, you know, what we see. Students who are economically disadvantaged and students with disabilities are areas where Delaware may want to focus some extra time. These areas are specific importance, as you can see that students are, you know, their scores have dropped the most significantly at grade 8. And we'll talk in just a minute about some reasons why that might be. Again, these are trends. Delaware was among, again, the 12 lower scoring jurisdictions in the country. The range of scores was 244 to 268. Delaware's average score was 249. So one of the other things that NAEP does do is ask some questions to offer up some opportunities in education. And one of the questions that it specifically focused on this year had to do with absenteeism. You can see here that across the country, absenteeism, according to self-reports from students, is actually on a downward trend since the pandemic. Of course, 19 was pre-pandemic, and then 2022 is fairly high. 2024 is illustrating that we're moving in a downward direction. I want to go to the next slide. This is not self-reported from students. This is actual data from Delaware. Our lowest was 13.2% in 2019. We were at our peak in 2022 at almost 25%, and we are moving significantly downward. We are now in 2022 with about 19.6% chronic absenteeism rates in the state. And that is actually quite significant. Chronic absenteeism is defined as missing about 10% or more of the school year. And it has been dropping since 2022. It does remain above pre-pandemic levels, but it is dropping. One of the things that we need to keep in mind, according to NAEP records and others, the lowest 25th percentile of students and economically disadvantaged students have a higher rate of chronic absenteeism than any other population of students, and they also tend to be the ones who are performing the worst on assessments such as NAEP. So working with our communities and families to try and mitigate some of the issues that are affecting absenteeism rates. So some of the things that you were talking about earlier this evening will likely affect some of those results just by virtue of having the students actually in the building. Yeah.
Question is, for this absenteeism for 2024, since we're in school year 2024, is that lagging data? Is that data up to this date?
That's where we are at this point.
At this point, okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Or in 2025. So that was up, that was for the fiscal year 24.
This?
Yeah.
School year 23-24. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm asking. Yeah. So, all right. Thank you.
Okay. So that is it for the actual presentation. I do want to share some other just contact information. If you have anything specific you'd like to discuss or questions, that's my information. And then we also have our NAEP State Coordinator, Fran Purnell. She will be contacting schools soon. So if you're in school or charter schools, just let them be aware that she'll be contacting them soon as we're moving into the 2026 rotation. One of the things we'd like our schools to really understand is that NAEP is important. We'd like our students to understand that it is important. We'd like them to take it seriously. We do, even if it is an autopsy or necropsy, right, the information is useful to us. As long as students take it seriously, then the information is something that we can definitely use in decision making. So, that's very helpful.
And that shouldn't be understated. I mean, there could be a claim that there's too much assessment or kids are taking too many tests. I understand that. And yet this one is one that we use to look nationally on how nation public schools are doing. And so ask a student to take it seriously when it doesn't impact their college entrance. Why would I take this, a fourth grader, an eighth grader? Like, why would I? But there's, have them understand the purpose of it is important. When I was a young baby teacher, I was pretty vocal about too many tests and my kids were taking too many assessments. I got really mad about it. Like, this isn't helping it wasn't NAEP, but whatever it was. And my mentor at the time, who unfortunately has passed away, said recently, but my mentor at the time said, Cindy, you just need to know in your long career, it was like my fourth or fifth year of teaching, in your long career in education, you're going to see 7 rounds of standardized testing. Why fight it? He probably is the one that used the term autopsy. I don't remember where I got that from. He goes, you teach your students, you give them what they need and they're going to do fine. And he was right. He said, you're going to see 7 rounds. I had the CAT 6, the SAT 9, the MAT 7, the CLASS for like 2 minutes in California, then the CST, then the SBAC. So I've seen 6 rounds in my career. I'm in my 36th year. So I bet SBAC someday is going to go away and there'll be a 7th and you can figure out how old I am. I think he was right. He was so correct. There's going to always be a way.
If it's not SBAC, it'll be something else.
It'll be something else. There will be a way that we do it. It's sort of teaching, assessment literacy matters mm-hmm. for our students. And for when people measure you, you're like, take that seriously, take that test and move on. But let's make the learning conditions right for our kids. Let's give our kids the opportunity to learn and learn at high levels. So whatever test gets put in front of them, it's not a distraction. It'll be a little bit of disruption the day that you got to go take that test, but then get right back to hands-on, minds-on, rigorous, relevant, meaningful learning in exquisite learning conditions, and we've delivered education. That's it. I'll be quiet. Everyone is great.
Thanks.
I appreciate it.
All right. If anybody needs anything, you know where to find me.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm fascinated by this data. Thank you.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you.
You very much. Any questions, send them to Kathleen. We'll get them sent over to you to answer.
Great.
An eye opener. Okay, next on the agenda, charter school updates. It is for information. Leroy Travers, Director of the Charter School Office and Associate Secretary of Operations. Kim Klein, is she here?
She's not here.
Okay. Leroy is here this evening to provide updates on the work at the Charter School Office. Mr. Travers, any updates to share?
Well, you have my report, which is just a a brief calendar of renewal events, upcoming renewal events. Tomorrow we are actually hosting a professional development session for the two renewing charter schools on curriculum instruction and professional development. There'll be a half day, and the team will review the requirements for curriculum as well as the rubrics and timelines. And then in April, we will go on site to provide some technical assistance just for the process, for the renewal process. So, and then one of or two of you lucky individuals get to serve on the Charter School Accountability Committee. So.
I was good at it.
Yeah, you guys are great. I was wondering if I could just give a brief high-level overview of the State Board's role as it pertains to charter schools for the benefit of Secretary Martin, and to kind of explain why I'm here in front of you each and every month. So, and I'll just keep it really brief. We'll probably go into it in more detail at some point, but the charter schools either apply for a new charter in our state, or they apply for renewal every 5 years, 10 years, or 4 years for a new charter school, or they may apply for a major modification. And the decisions made by on those applications are made by the secretary. However, the secretary then asks for the state board for the assent to the secretary's decision on those applications. And those applications do not move forward without the assent of the state board. So that just gives a reason why I'm here and provide these reports each and every month. Are there questions?
You always count me.
I do. I enjoy being here.
Any questions for Mr. Travers? All right. Well, thank you, sir. Thanks for coming, and have a good night. Next on the agenda, regulations, Delaware Department of Education regulations for discussion or action. Dale Matusevich, Director of Exceptional Children Resources, is here to review three regulations for action. Welcome back. Feels like you've been here frequent flyer model.
Get right up.
Just get right to it.
So yes, so hopefully this will be brief, and Lisa Henry, our chief of staff, is also here, and she has been holding my hand through this process. So Del Matusevich, the director for Exceptional Children Resources, through this process, I think the department has learned we lost a valuable asset when Tina retired, because she was the guru with formatting all of our regulations and so forth as we sent them over to the registrar's office to go into the registry. So we are back in front of you again tonight to ask for approval. There is no content changes within the regulations that you formally approved back, I believe, in October. We just, as we've sent them to the registrar's office, they kept coming back to us with formatting issues that we have gotten a lot of training from the registrar's office, I believe. Correct, Lisa? On trying to get things formatted correctly. We do have it formatted correctly now. Those have been for you. So we are just bringing those back. No content changes. It was just formatting issues. So we're bringing those back for approval, so we can get those over and get them printed into the registry.
Thank you. If there are no questions, is there a motion regarding regulations 922, 923, and 925?
A question in terms of the date of effectiveness is July 1.
Yes, that was one of the pieces that we were clarifying for the registrar's office. In the past, we have attempted to make changes in the middle of the year, and it has caused great confusion. So we did put the implementation date for July 1 at the start of the new year. We have begun already discussing the upcoming implementation changes with our LEAs. So they are already in preparation for that as we move forward.
Is there a motion?
Griffin, I move the acceptance of regulations 922, 923, and 925 as revised.
Griffin has made a motion. Is there a second?
Simmons, second.
Simmons is second. It has been moved and seconded. Is there any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstention? Motion carries. Thank you and have a good evening.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, Professional Standards Board regulations for discussion or action. Dr. Linnea Bradshaw, Executive Director of the Professional Standards Board, will review three regulations for action and then one for information. Welcome. Good to see you.
I am also a frequent flyer. I'm here every month. And welcome, Secretary Martin. And I feel Dale's pain because my fit formatting was all done by our DAG previous to her leaving in November. And so it has been a steep learning curve to hand do all of the things that she did for us. So here's to a speedy hiring of a new DAG. We'll see how well that goes. 1517 was published in the month of January, and we passed it through in February. It received two comments from the State Council of Persons with Disabilities and the Governor's Council for Exceptional Children. They were both in favor of the proposed regulations. The main amendment, if you recall, is that when we originally wrote this reg, we thought that the equivalent of a diploma was a GED. It's not technically the equivalent of a diploma. It is a secondary credential. And so there is an equivalent to a diploma that is like the Groves diploma or a different type of diploma. And so we were just correcting a mistake that I think it was existing language from a long time ago. But it's the diploma equivalent of a high school diploma approved by a state or a secondary credential approved by a state. We didn't want to say GED because there are many states that use many different assessments. It passed unanimously by the PSB at their February 6th meeting. Are there any questions? All right. All of our regs had comments. Do you want me to do all three of them together or no?
All three of them together, yes, because we're going to motion them all three together.
Oh, okay. So 1552 is a repeal of the Family and Consumer Sciences regulation. It received one comment, but the board found that the comment was unrelated to the regulation and made no changes because of the comment. And we are simply not issuing this regulation beyond September 1st, 2025, which was when the current praxis sunsets, and we are not adopting a new praxis. These folks will be certified under our CTE regulation. All right, so 1572. Again, we had three comments. The first comment was only tangentially possibly related to the regulation, but we received comments from the Governor's Council for Exceptional Citizens and the State Council of Persons with Disabilities. They were against the regulation, mainly because it is certified through micro-credentials, and they didn't believe that micro-credentials are equivalent to an educator prep program. But when we deliberated on the comments, we couldn't really tell if they were talking about what they meant by an educator prep program, because the gifted and talented certificate is a second cert. Everyone already has to be a certified elementary or secondary teacher in order to get this additional credential. And the other issue is that there are no in-state programs. There have not been for 10 years. And so we have used professional development. It had been a series of Schoology courses. Those were sunset in 2024, and we replaced those with the micro-credentials. And so because there really weren't any other alternatives, and because the department has already approved the micro-credentials to be a program, even if we removed these from the regulation in 4116, the language in 4114 that covers department approved programs would have covered it. It would not have taken them out of the being an approved program. So for that reason, the board did not make any changes.
Thank you. Any questions from board members on these three regulations? If there are no questions, is there a motion regarding regulations 1517, 1554, and 1572?
Just one question. You had mentioned one was going to be sunset. I wanted to make sure I understood you. Was that the comment for regulation 1554? This is Powell speaking. You said something about one being sunsetted.
So 1554, Family and Consumer Science, says will no longer be issued as of September 1st, 2025. And so instead, those folks will be in the hospitality and teacher academy pathways. So they'll be certified under skilled and technical science as teacher. So it isn't as if we'll have no culinary hospitality teachers, but the focus of CTE programs is a career focus. And so Family and Consumer Sciences as a discipline doesn't necessarily fit the current model of the CTE programs or the vision of the Delaware CTE cadre.
Thank you, clear.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, no further questions. Is there a motion?
Irvin Powell, so moved.
Irvin Powell's made a motion. I need a second.
Be a second.
Obvious second. It has been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries.